Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on the nature of consciousness and life continuum as revealed through near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences. Some of our topics include what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature a stellar roster of special guests of both experiences and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. For more information about our organization, Toward the Light, and our radio program, please do visit our website, towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. This week I'm very pleased to have someone who's a magnificent film producer and visionary who produced the film Dragons and Rings. Welcome to Toward the Light, Mr. Steve Mitchell. Hello, Steve.
Hiya, how are you doing, Juliet?
Oh, not bad, and it's wonderful to finally get you, and apologize for the delay here, but there's been lots of technical stuff going on. And maybe the eclipse and some other solar activity is interfering with things a bit too. But I'm really pleased to have you on the show, because as I was watching your DVD, I was so deeply moved by the content. And indeed, it reminded me of so much that I've experienced, not only during my near-death states, but also other spiritually transformative experiences. What I would like to do first is start by asking you, what got you into this work that led to the production of Dragons and Rings?
My journey, I guess, started way back in my youth. I kind of lived down in a very magical part of the country that was surrounded by stone circles, by very magical places, full of mist, full of wonder, full of history. And it inspired me. Something very special, something very magical about that when you're young. And I used to walk up and down places like the Ridgeway, which is a huge kind of Roman road near where I used to live, that, like I say, is scattered with these ancient sites. In the midst of it, I guess, childhood is full of magic, it's full of wonder, it's full of all those special things, and yet your brain starts to kind of seek to find a meaning, it seeks to find a truth. And I kind of work with both sides of my brain, always have. So there's part of my brain that is very creative, very in touch, very kind of in attune, if you like, to this kind of magical kind of state of being. And yet there's the other half of my brain that's very kind of logical, that's very mathematical, that's very scientific, that seeks explanation, that seeks it in a pattern, in a mode, if you like. And I guess that's what's informed my journey all the way through. As much as kind of seeing things and taking them on board as experience, I seek to sort of question those experiences, question those meanings, question what's going on in there, and seek to find reason. And hence, you know, when I hit university time, I ended up studying both music and maths, which some people say is a very strange combination. Other people say, oh, you know, music and maths go together, which obviously, once you kind of get into the crux of it, they do. And I guess I started looking, in terms of all these mysteries, in terms of all these magic, and all this sort of special things, and finding the point at which they did meet, finding the point at which, for example, music and the creativity of music and the beauty of music is expressed through number, is expressed through science. And the same kind of with the world, I guess, the beauty of the world, the wonder of the world, the magic of the world that the artist sees, that the visionary or creative side of us sees and perceives, is expressed simultaneously through number, through science, through angle, through degree, through something that we can also measure and something that we kind of put in a model, in a concrete model that we can say, yes, this is definitely happening, and yes, this is why it's happening. And that's kind of come out, really, in this film, Dragons and Rings, which is just kind of a step along the way. It's part of my journey, and it kind of sums up the first few years, first 20, 30 years of my journey, up as far to where I'd got at that point.
Well, I've got to say, when I was, watching the film and then also reading about your biography, I thought, blimey, how much we've got in common, really. I think the one difference is that for some reason, math seems to elude me, even though, ironically, I'm very interested in numbers and likewise I'm interested in science, even though, funnily enough, all of my life I've been a mystic and I've also lived in that magic. Well, coming from the North Country, and I think also because of my serious lack of health as a child, it kept pushing me into really residing in other dimensions and not being caught up in the physical third dimensional quote definition of reality. So likewise, I felt like, we need some explanations of this. But at the same time, so many of the explanations are loaded with misinformation. So I'm so pleased with the work that you've been doing, because you actually are more along the lines of the scientific researcher who is embracing the higher realities, as opposed to what the neurophysicist Mario Beauregard regards to as the strictly materialistic scientist, skeptic, and they're not willing to move beyond what they can perceive and apply since reality. So when I saw your film, just a few days ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who is going to be on Toward the Light, and she's also into bridging the gap between science and intuition, or science and metaphysics. And we were talking about the ley lines, and she even said something about she felt like they were moving, that there was some sort of shift with the ley lines. And I said, well, actually, what makes my homeland so powerful is that that's where the majority of them really converge. And so I would love for you to share a bit about this, because, there really is deep meaning to it, and I think people need to have a deeper understanding. Of course, you were able to put it in such beautiful words, and even words that lay people can understand, whereas to me it's still so ineffable. I can grok it through my experience, but I do have a hard time explaining it. But why don't you share some of the, if you can, some of what you're talking about in the film, because it's so very well explains what I've actually experienced, and I'm sure you have too, with all that magic and wonder and being interdimensional, which is very important to address, because indeed we are interdimensional. So why don't we start? I noticed you were talking about the crystals sort of conversing with each other, as it were, and just some of the things that you were able to uncover from our magical homeland.
You, I'm going to grab you there just for a second. Whereabouts in England do you come from?
I'm from Lancashire.
Oh, right. I was trying to put the accent in. It's very strange knowing that I'm kind of talking across the lake, as it were.
Yeah.
And you've got this kind of English accent, but just this hint of American accent in there, and it's kind of like, oh, right. Kind of quite confusing from this end in a weird way. It's strange how we kind of put those kind of envelopes on things and create realities from those kind of perceptions of what we expect and what we get.
Yes, exactly. Especially when you've been all over the place and it's been influential, I'm sure.
Ley lines. I think it's probably a relatively good place to start. You mentioned there that someone had talked to you about the ley lines moving and changing and so forth, and someone the other day on radio asked me about this. My perception, if I can try and kind of put it in a nutshell, it's so much easier. One thing with DVDs is, first of all, you've got a script so you can stand and read it, so you've kind of planned well ahead of where you're going to go to. And secondly, you've got the pictures that you kind of set up in a DVD and a film, which are so important to help people kind of see what's going on. My perception of ley lines is very simple, and it goes both into a quantum perspective, that is a scientific perspective of the world, as an energetic being, as an energetic thing. upon which matter is created. But that's also expressed in most religions, in most base philosophies. If you study the Pythagoreans, if you study the Egyptians, if you study the early Indians, if you study Native Americans, the Aboriginals, all of these cultures have this kind of concept that the world in its base form is energy. And on top of that, we get a physical sense that kind of materializes, that manifests as part of that energy. If you like, what happens is a waveform is the energetic part of that, and the vibration of the waveform creates solid. So if you can imagine the world as energy, as pure energy, at its minutest part, if you could look at it down a microscope, and I think this is kind of the point to which quantum maths and quantum physics is coming now, they perceive it much as a matrix of energy, literally building blocks of energetic lines, very tiny with little nodes. So if you can imagine a cube and along the edges of the cube running energy and each of those being joined at the points of the cube and loads of those stacked on top of them until they literally make the world and the universe indeed as we know it. And that's the basic formation for what we call ley lines. Now, the kind of, to me, the biggest misconception, and you know, you kind of get these ideas as you go along, you check them out, and then you change your ideas. I think that's part of the beauty, part of the magic of this all, is that you're never quite there. You're always one step away from whatever the next step away is.
Yes.
So you present an idea, you present a perspective, and you're already kind of seeing things, you talk to people and you look at stuff and you think, oh, actually, maybe, you know. So that's the most root basic thing, just a simple matrix of energy, and that's it. Minute energy, which in its own turn, in its own pattern, kind of interacts with itself and builds upon itself, a bit like a wall of sound. Some sounds work together and make sounds bigger. Some sounds work against each other and make themselves smaller, make themselves less voluminous. And so ley lines themselves are initially a manifestation of this kind of build-up of energy, where the energy points enhance each other, where they vibrate against each other, then they make bigger energy points, bigger amounts of energy lines. But then, you know, if you like, kind of, these lines get major, a little bit like perhaps the arteries and veins in our body. The veins are sort of very, very small lines of blood energy, for want of a better way. And the arteries are kind of bigger versions of those. And that's how I see ley lines as they start. Does that make sense?
Oh, it definitely does. And you know, for me, it was very interesting during the near-death states and being completely out of body and moving far and away from it. I was actually right after I was told that I had to come back to this physical realm, which of course I didn't want to, I was reminded that it's an illusion. And so, you know, for years and years I've been talking about this plane as being a hologram. Also, when I looked upon it from the other dimensions, it was not solid at all. It was in waves and particles. It was very transparent, but again, just seeing these waves. So I could see how unfolded it actually is, that it really is a projection coming from consciousness. And I think about the energy, this energy that is everywhere, and that it is with... It is conscious energy. It is, the consciousness, of course, the seat of the consciousness is love. So, when I was seeing all this, I thought there's such a special perfection around all of this. And you were pointing out that people for thousands upon thousands of years, or civilizations or what have you, have had this awareness and have been using it, and yet the majority of the human population is totally ignorant about this. And so I wanted to really get into this, you know, how people can really better understand really how the universe works, and like to get more into your understanding of the multiple dimensions, because you did mention that too. I meant to take notes with some of the words that you used, and I didn't have a chance to do that. You used some great scientific terms, and you were leading from one thing to the next. It was beautifully done, really. Again, we're talking about Dragons and Rings, a lovely, lovely DVD. Tell us, you know, what when you started doing this research, what some of the work was that you did and what you uncovered in the process?
I guess initially it started out very inspirational, very observational, very kind of part of something that was happening. Like I said earlier on, I was surrounded and certainly sort of fed myself with information from all kind of areas of, if you like, esoteric life, in terms of kind of knowledge, belief systems, the magical thought, all that sort of stuff. And like I said, because I have this kind of mathematical scientific bent, because my left brain insists on jumping up and down and not taking everything for granted, I tend to look at something and think, well, how does that work? Why does it work? Does it work? Is it reality, or is it something that we manifest? Is it something that we do make in our head? And I guess in a way we end up in that kind of philosophical quandary, you know, is reality what we see? Do we really see it? Do we really hear it? Are we who we are? You know, do we exist because we think? And all that sort of stuff. So I guess that's where I started from. And, you know, within that kind of field, I've been lucky enough to talk to a lot of people, chat to a lot of people, have scientific kind of persuasion as well as esoteric persuasion. And within there, you experience as well. So one of the things I mentioned within the DVD is the use of dowsing, and dowsing is an amazingly interesting tool once you kind of figure out what's going on with dowsing. One of the big things with dowsing is that most people think that it's something external, some kind of spirit maybe, something that moves the pendulum that you're working with, and when you come down to it, it's just still moving the pendulum. And all the pendulum becomes is a device, is a measuring device that links to us as beings. And what it means is that as beings, as physical beings, we are amazing, because we are in connection with this energy, and that we're part of this energy. And because we're part of that energy, and because we are the energy, and the energy is us, if you like, that's why it seems to be physical, that's why it seems to be real to us, because it is the same energy, the same wavelength of energy that we're kind of working with. And so within those realms, because we have those connections, some people, you know, apply language, if you like, in terms of calling it intuitional or whatever, it doesn't really matter, language becomes a massive barrier for so many people. But because we have connections on that energetic level, we're able to measure the world energetically and physically, and we're able to connect to those connections, those subconscious connections, and effectively sort of measure them. So that becomes an amazingly kind of good tool out there, if you like. But then, I guess, you know, everything... The one thing that you mentioned in there, you know, we've mentioned is scientists have the issue that they tend to condense their knowledge. They tend to work in very specific areas, and because they work in very specific areas, they become very knowledgeable on that side of things. They tend to ignore everything outside of their remit, everything outside of their own envelope. So their reality becomes very, very blinkered by what they research, by what they specialize in, and they don't get to see the whole picture. And I guess what I've done is I've taken that step away, and I'm doing my best to bring in as many pictures as absolutely possible that we can kind of bring into the pattern, like I say, ranging way back into the Pythagorean thought, and into esoteric Indian thought and so forth, and bringing that way up to date with even Newtonian thought, as well as quantum thought and Maxwellian thought, putting them all into the same bracket and saying, whoa, actually, they do fit. They do have this kind of consensus of opinion that suggests the world is an energetic thing, and that energetic thing has some relationship to us, and therefore we manifest or manipulate it by thinking through it and with it.
And would you say that it's actually as a result of getting into this quantum physics and all of that that has enabled us to really address things on an energetic level? Because I know for myself, and you know, I've been around on this planet for a little while now, and I saw that unfortunately I was the victim of people saying, oh, you're not in touch with reality. Reality to them just being what they can experience again on the five sensory level, which is not reality at all. And I'm very pleased of the fact that now there have been so many people like yourself who have been able to come forward and say reality is not confined to what people perceive on the physical plane. And a really good example of this is that you and I are both Reiki practitioners. And a lot of people wonder, well, how does that work? It's so simple, you just hold your hands in a certain way or what have you. And I do remote healing literally all over the world, and it's amazing how effective it is. But then how do we explain that to somebody who's trying to grapple all of this from what I would consider a rather limited perspective? You know, the whole thing for, and I think the big thing with us in the ears, why we're having these experiences, why we've come back to talk about it, say, you know, we don't die. We do continue to exist outside of the physical body because it's just a casing that we use whilst we traverse this plane. So there's a lot of what I would venture to call proof, to consider proof, that there is so much more to reality than, again, what people perceive on the physical plane. And that's why I appreciate people like you who are able to, you know, we've got, as I said, this marriage of science and mysticism going on now, which I'm very grateful for, bringing this more into play. And I noticed in Dragons and Rings, you were talking about the fact, you used one of my favorite words, in fact, a multiverse, that we live in a multiverse. That's so excellent. Why don't we talk about this a bit? Because if, I think you'd be able to explain it better than I can. I know it from experiencing it, but how would you explain that if you're able to, or describe some of this stuff to our listeners?
It's so tricky without the pretty pictures.
Yeah, I understand that too. Blimey, yes.
So I think I might put some pretty pictures on my Dragons and Rings website for people to look at. I kind of use the Pythagorean model because it's a lovely model to exemplify what's going on, but it kind of twists in on itself, and the first and hardest step to take on board is how they perceive numbers, and it kind of leads us onto dimensions and multi-dimensions, so I'll do my best to place it in a kind of talk way without actually using the pictures, even though I've kind of got my hands moving on the other end of the phone and pictures going on in my head as I'm kind of doing it. Imagine a kind of like this energetic nothing. You might call it nothing, but it isn't nothing on its own. It is something. It's something very special because there's some form of consciousness, if you like, there's some form of thought to it, some form of existence, and every single, both scientific perspective and esoteric perspective and mystical perspective, all agree that, if you like, the zero point, the black mass of energy, the nothing, the formative zero, the formative kind of egg, the formative embryo, all this sort of stuff has some consciousness to it, has some thought to it. And within all of this, imagine a kind of single point appearing as if by magic. A single zero point, but in itself, it doesn't know what it is. It's just a point of energy that's fluctuated to become a kind of point of mass, a single particle, if you like, the first particle of the universe. Kind of like that first particle of the Big Bang before everything goes kaboom into everything. And that particle is still absolutely in the middle of nowhere. It hasn't got any space around itself to map. It hasn't got any up and down. It hasn't got any left or right. It hasn't got any forward or backwards, simply because there's nothing to map onto. There's nothing else to look at apart from itself.
Mm.
So, effectively, what the Pythagoreans consider is that as a result of this single point, as a result of this number one, if you like, there must be a number two. There has to be for it to exist. A bit like the philosophical phrase, I think, therefore I am.
Yes.
In order for us to think, in order for us to be, there has to be something else. There has to be a mirror. There has to be something to look into, yes?
Absolutely.
And once you've got that second point to look at, you can map yourself relatively to that second point. You can look at it and say, well, that second point's over here, over there, and I'm over here. And effectively, you therefore draw a line between yourself and that second point. And that line becomes your first dimension, of, shall we say, forwards and backwards. But again, you know, in this magic space of absolutely nothing, those two points still don't know quite where they are in relation to both up and down and sideways and the other side. So again, the magical third point has to come into being, according to the Pythagoreans, in order for those two points to reference. So once that third point is there, the two points can say, well, those two points and a line are so far away from that third point. And that third point now becomes the number three as well, which is really important in, again, in Pythagorean mathematics, because it's the first real number. It's the first real number because it's the first number that includes reference points for itself. As far as the Pythagoreans are concerned, neither one nor two are real numbers. If you've got those three points, you can then not only map lines between those three points, you can also draw across from those three lines, two other lines, to effectively create a surface, a single surface that now has forwards and backwards as well as sideways. So it's now a two-dimensional surface. And if you think about that surface, you back to the original problem of, well, we know the surface is there, we know we have a kind of flat world now, if you like. That flat world can extend left and right, forward and backwards for absolutely ever. But we don't know how high, how tall that flat world is, because we haven't got a way to measure that. So you need to then bring in your fourth point of dimension, which is height, which is actually the third dimension, but it's the fourth reference point, height. And that starts to now enable us then to imagine and to be solid. We can be solid because we can now be length, we can be width, and we can be height. But until we can move around that solid, until we can see ourselves from all sides, we still don't know how big that solid is. And the act of moving in itself becomes moving through time. So that solid moves through time, which brings in our next dimension. Once you're on the time dimension, you can actually think that, well, time itself is only a measurement, a relative measurement to what? It isn't a relative measurement to energy. So then we need another dimension beyond time. And this is where most people kind of get stuck. What we tend to do is we organize things in our brain and our memory in discrete units and little blocks that are each kind of cut up from the next block into seconds, into milliseconds, or into hours, or months, or years, or whatever. But all of those are discrete units because they don't include the flow of time in themselves. They're like photographs, for example, in a photograph album. All those photographs are static. They're just single points in time. The points in time within those that start to move them is the memory part of that. That's when you start trying to go, ooh, we can kind of move that around. So we need another dimension, let's say, beyond time. And once you work out that you need another dimension in beyond time, effectively you also need another dimension beyond that. You also need another dimension beyond that. And the multi-dimension of the universe is that effectively, by its own existence, by its own creation of its first point, it has to therefore create these multiple, multiple, multiple points which relate each to the previous points, and that's where we end up with this conception, if you like, of multi-dimensionality. Scientists jump up and down and argue about whether there's 11 or 12 or 14 or 27 or 31 dimensions. You could probably limit it, or you could argue that it's absolutely infinite. And it's our perception, our limitations, that actually suggest that it is limited, not what it is. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, even with all the experiences and the research that I've done, I thought, well, you know, I'm starting to figure some things out, but then the moment I think that, I realize I've still got so much to learn, and we're still going to be limited by what we can, you know, perceive and then, you know, through experiences. But one thing that was interesting for me is that during my near-death states and every time I've been out of body and what have you, I experience no space-time as people do on this plane. In fact, everything was experienced in the now. And again, this is so ineffable to me. How do we explain this? And I'm sure people nod their heads and wonder, what is that like? And yet at the same time, so many of us actually share the same experience, you know, that it really is radically different once we are out of our bodies, once we are out of the limiting perspective and vantage point of the physical, mindset and what have you, everything completely changes. And like, for example, when people talk about having their life review and they're able to experience all of that, their entire life simultaneously, a friend of mine, PMH Atwater, wrote in a book called Future Memory. She actually describes a lot of this and does a beautiful description with that. And there's also an image that she put in the book, which I actually thought I saw on your DVD, which is referred to as a torus. It's sort of like a whirling, how do you call it, donut.
Donut, absolutely, yes.
But it's very, very powerful, and it seemed like when you were describing, you know, these points and then how they just moved into infinity, and then suddenly I saw this beautiful image whirling around. Now, you may have had a different name for it. I'm trying to remember now. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. The point about them is that what you end up with in reality is kind of inner direct dimensions rather than outer dimensions. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
If you think about dimensions, they're all at right angles to each other. So, for example, if you were to look at a table or chair, the length of the table or chair or whatever it is, I'm gazing at the table at the moment, is at right angles to the height of the table, at right angles to the legs. The width of the table, so going along the other side, is at right angles to both of those. But time, when you actually work it out, is actually at right angles to those. It starts to kind of twist around on itself. And the next dimension twists around on itself again. So what you get is an internal kind of, rather than outwards kind of going on into infinity, you've got this internal kind of twisting around, very much like the fractal images produced by mathematics and computers in the sort of 80s and 90s. You've got this kind of twisting around that kind of goes forever on and in itself, which is where we find, if you like, those dimensions. They are inside. A couple of examples that came to mind whilst you were talking. First of all, I think people do appreciate that time isn't linear. They do appreciate this in a lot of experiences. And one of the ones that I kind of highlighted in the film Dragons and Rings was the fact that when we're driving, sometimes a journey can seem, oh, I don't know, amazingly fast. We kind of leave a house and we get to somewhere amazingly quickly. And yet, you know, another time we could go on the same journey, and you know, the same circumstances, and it seems to take forever. We can be stuck in a traffic jam, and, you know, time just seems to be ticking slowly away, and yet it's only been a matter of sort of minutes, and the minutes seem longer and longer and longer. And yet, you know, we're on the road, and we're speeding along the highway, enjoying ourselves, and, you know, those minutes suddenly just slip away, and before we know it, it's kind of been and gone. But the interesting thing about time is that it's a concept, it's a structure, a bit like in the film The Matrix. It's created in our heads, and it is literally a memory. It's a remembrance of times past that we've arranged in an order. And even as we're speaking, even as people are listening at this second, they're remembering what I've just said. So they're actually remembering now, me saying, even as we're speaking, even as we're listening this second. So that's already become a memory. So everything that is past is a single memory inside our head, stored a bit like you might sort of think on a CD or on a record or on a tape or something. That also means that the future kind of time is also in our head, because it's about to happen, but it's already happened because it's already moved into the future. That gets slightly kind of philosophical, but it's all in there. And effectively, when you kind of come to this point where you're saying, well, you know, we remember our life almost as though it's all in one instant, it is. It is literally there. Time is only this kind of measurement, this tick-tock that we kind of apply linearly and split it up into all these little frames, all these little photographs. But in reality, our whole life is contained within our being, within our head, within our brain, within our spirit, within ourselves. As we are now, we are the result of who we are and who we're going to be in the moment of now.
Yes, yes. And that's why PMH Atwater has talked about this in her book, Future Memory. It's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, she's a fellow near-death experience, and we've been able to, you know, grasp so much of this as a result of the experiences that we've been through. And just, it's so, so powerful, and it's hopefully stretches way beyond the confines again of what I'm just going to say, people have been very myopic and materialistic, who just can't seem to get their arms around anything beyond what they can perceive on the physical plane. But again, my friend David Icke also has spoken about that all the data is already intact on the DVD or a CD, but as you're playing it, you're experiencing this sort of linear process. But everything is still already there. So funnily enough, whilst when we are outside of the confines of the physical or third dimensions, we're actually able to experience everything all together. And so, like when, again, people have the life review, somehow we are able to experience and see the whole thing from beginning to end, right in the now.
Another nice way to put it is that some people may well be listening to this now on your station, maybe a day or two after we've actually done it. They might well be tuning in, and they might be listening to the recording of it. And this whole conversation that they're listening to, this chat between us, that maybe will have taken an hour or two or whatever it's going to take, is stored on a computer somewhere with a set of digits that are simply there. They're not in any time at all. They're just there. They're just waiting to be. And they only become, if you like, that piece of time when someone plays it, when someone presses the start button and starts to listen to it in linear time. But in reality, the whole of this conversation will be on that computer and will be sitting there stored as a kind of single unit, if you like. Mm-hmm. And that, I guess, is as close to maybe understanding that experience that maybe some people can get to. But then again, philosophically, if you can get to that place where you understand that, where you can kind of be that, then you start to get to that place where you can apply that to all kinds of things, where you can kind of manipulate your perception of time, manipulate the way you think about time and how it kind of passes for you and how important it is for you. I guess, I mean, a big problem for most people is that we struggle to define what reality means to us. We struggle to define something beyond the world of the here and now, something beyond the world of getting up in the morning, going to work, getting home, watching the telly and going to sleep. And we're looking for that something extra special, that sort of extra meaning that adds on to it. And if that meaning conflicts with our meaning, then it starts to become very kind of, we feel ill at ease, we start to get scared when people kind of put their own stuff on top of that, when we start to interfere with each other's kind of life patterns, it becomes quite a scary time for us, until we appreciate the kind of point that we're at, that sort of point that really we're kind of living with each other, we're living in this kind of conjoined, shared universe, that our experience depends on other people's experience, and their experience depends on ours, and that the kind of creation act, the creation of reality, the creation, the making of the now, the making of the future, depends on so many other strands in a kind of, again, in a quantum sense, in a thread theory sense. It depends on the fact that we are all interlinked, that we're all part of this energy, we're all part of the here and now, we're all part of each other.
Well, that's such a wonderful point you're making too, and I was thinking again, going back to childhood, that we are by nature so in touch with this. You know, you were talking about the magic and wonder that you experienced as a child, and as did I. And, you know, unfortunately, people are, you know, they start to be conditioned out of it. Well, now you've got to be so-called educated in this institution so you can learn how to grow up and make money. But that's not really what we're about. That's not who we are. So we lose touch with who we are. We lose touch with that magic and wonder and awe and indeed being in touch with other realities, which are all real. And so, you know, I experienced the ridicule here and there from different people who said, well, you're not in touch with reality. You're living in a dream world and all of that nonsense. And it was actually as a result of my adult near-death experiences that validated what I already knew, what I was, and unfortunately what I was being ridiculed for. So these have been a tremendous gift because, again, what you're bringing up in your beautiful Dragons and Rings is this power, this knowledge, this wisdom, this truth, this reality that has been in existence for thousands upon thousands of years, and that there were civilizations who had direct knowledge and experience of this. And I'm thinking that a number of us are being used to reawaken this awareness, so that as divine beings we can claim back our power and our rightful heritage, that we're not just flesh and bone, far from.
I think it's quite tricky, isn't it, on these phones across countries. I'm sure you must find the same problem.
It's almost like being
on one of those CB phones, isn't it? You kind of almost have to say over and out at the end of every sentence, you know, when to dive in.
Yes, yes. But go ahead with your thought. I'm really...
I'll come back with yours again. To me, the real importance is getting that balance absolutely right.
Yes.
I think, you know, I'll go into another side of it in a second. I think one thing to remember is that we do live in the here and now, and in order to live in the here and now, we have to kind of manifest in the here and now. And that means, basically, in order to kind of bring a roof over our heads and bring food into our mouths, we have to kind of live in a world that recognizes money as a bartering system. And I think the important thing is, if you can realize beyond that, if you can colorize that, then it starts to have so much more of a meaning. If you recognize that even money in itself is a magical system. It's a magical system that enables you or I or anyone else to integrate with each other and to accept and give to each other. It enables us to say, right, we need to live somewhere, so therefore we will accept that, and a way to live is in order to make money. But that money that we make enables us to bring happiness, if you like, to bring that kind of prosperity, to bring something special into our lives, using that in a kind of way, both physical and spiritual kind of matter. And I think, you know, it becomes a quandary that people assume that in order to be spiritual, you can't be materialistic, and that's absolutely wrong, because spirituality and materialism go hand in hand, and they always have been. And this goes again way back to the point at which we actually settled down and stopped becoming nomadic. We saw the world, we realized that the world was full of sun, if you like, because we followed the sun. But at some point we also felt that we wanted to settle down. We wanted to become part of a specific place in that world. And in order to become part of that specific place in the world, you have to almost become more magical, because you have to learn this kind of magic of science, the magic of the stars, the magic of navigation, the magic of geography and geometry, the magic of the seasons. And I guess in this day and age, what we've lost is that element of the magic, the element of the magic that we kind of do we look out the window and think, oh, actually it's summer, or do we look out the window and think it's winter, and do we appreciate what that season means to us and why it means anything to us and why it should impact on everything from our kind of spiritual perspective, our material perspective, our sexuality perspective, everything it kind of impacts on. And again, you know, a lot of people are far too happy to shut the doors, close the windows, close the curtains, switch the telly on, and ignore the outside. And they kind of miss the fact that without that outside, without that season, without the magical ability to measure the season, to measure the time, to actually put that into a structured material basis, we wouldn't be able to actually live the life that we live.
And I think one thing that's very important is to be aware of, you know, to allow ourselves a sensitivity to be aware of everything that is around us. And I think of myself when I'm taking a walk, and I can actually feel all the different energies that are surrounding me, and how many people will actually take the time to be aware of the energy going through them as they're taking a walk somewhere, what have you. And you know, one question I would like to ask you, we've still got a little bit more time, to talk about the crop circles a little bit. In fact, I think a new one has just recently shown up in the UK, hasn't it, as of last month, am I correct?
Do you know, I haven't been looking, I've been very remiss. I normally get emails in to tell me what's going on, and my emails have gone down for the last 3 weeks. With the real world. A friend of mine's down in Avery at the moment. And the last I heard from them was a few days ago. They seem to be popping in and out, and have been doing certainly for the last 2 months. Where are we going with this? Where are we heading to? What are top circles?
Yes, exactly. And the different energies that you experience whilst you're visiting them. I want to say I believe it was 22nd July.
Right.
Another one. I saw photographs of it online, and it was just stunning. In fact, it almost looked to me like the eclipse that we just had with the new moon solar eclipse on the 1st August. I know that Comet Holmes was also revealed in one of the crop circles. So I just wanted to get your input about your experiences and understanding of these crop circles.
I've read a lot of people have got a lot to say about crop circles and where they come from and where they don't come from. A couple of people that really kind of inform me, if you like, and certainly that kind of fits in with the way I look at things, Andy Collins and Freddie Silver. They both looked at crop circles from an energetic point of view, and I believe they're both absolutely right in the way that they were thinking. Again, a lot of science has been done as well, by the way, into crop circles, and not a lot of people kind of realize this, maybe because most of the scientists out there doing it tend to keep their heads down because they all have kind of very important kind of government jobs, so I'm not going to mention anyone by name. But surprisingly enough, you know, people who are extremely high-ranking scientists that people would think, you know, they've got their heads to the ground, they're really in touch with reality, are out there looking at what's going on. And there's a reason why they're looking at what's going on as well, because of something to do with certainly the energy and the way they're working. Again, the easiest way to do is to go back to this matrix concept, the original matrix concept that I was talking about, oh, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour ago, the world is built on. Within this perspective, the matrix of energy itself is a free flow energy. It goes from A to B to C to D and just simply flows, and the rhythm goes up and down, the frequency goes up and down, all kinds of things. And what has happened is that at some point, and I'm not going to go into this in too much depth because it's kind of going to be a focus of something I'm writing at the moment book-wise, but at some point we popped stones into that matrix, and we've also popped other structures into that matrix, and the impact of those is to change that matrix and make it flow in different directions. And it's certainly obvious if you study the kind of energetic formations within stone circles, the energetic formations within stone structures, everything from churches to pyramids, that there's something very specific going on frequency-wise and energy-wise in those structures that implies that the knowledge of those structures was there when they were built. They weren't randomly, they weren't just kind of stone structures that were there to just look at where the sun was, or just look at where the moon was, or the stars were. They had a very kind of wide-ranging purpose, which included manipulating this energy. So what happens is that because of those structures, because even of our own structures, our own settlements, and indeed us, and that becomes a very important part later on, the energy tends to kind of build up in those places. It also tends to build up in those places with relation to the geographic anomalies around those places. So, for example, the amount of water in the subsoil, the amount of crystalline structure will also build up to affect those energy processes. And at some point, that energy has got to dissipate. It's got to kind of go somewhere. So what it tends to do is go along the line of least resistance, and at some point that energy kind of fills up, goes flashing off somewhere, and effectively goes ba-doom, bang, whatever. And to my mind, that's what the crop circles are effectively created by, is this build-up and dissipation of energy. The energy patterns themselves that have been built up at those sites dictate the patterns within the crop circle, that at least partly dictates. And this comes to another important thing, because they're an interactive process, they seem to interact with us, and we seem to somehow have some kind of effect upon crop circles, upon the patterning. And indeed a lot of research has been done to show that you can, if you like, project the pattern into a crop circle. So what I really believe is going on is that we're effectively having a kind of dialogue with ourselves through these crop circles. Crop circles, by the way, have been around for at least several hundred years. There's documented evidence of them. And so consequently, I guess, again, going back to the point at which we start talking to ourselves, back to that kind of reflective point in the mirror, I think, therefore I am, we start questioning things and we start looking for answers. And what the whole kind of crop circle phenomenon seems to be is almost our own internal dialogue that becomes an external dialogue with ourselves and with the universe that we are. It becomes that kind of pattern, that geometric pattern of numbers, the geometric pattern of shapes, the geometric pattern of pictures that are really our kind of subconscious, and maybe the world subconscious, the universal subconscious, interacting with us to create kind of messages to and from ourselves.
I was having the thought too, this interesting vision came to mind, almost like the crop circles could be a huge thought form that is projected by the collective consciousness, or a group of collective consciousness, if that makes any sense. Because, you know, on the deepest level, we are all connected at all times, even consciously, and I'm not talking about the consciousness being transmitted through the physical or ego brain, but our soul self, our true self, we are always connected, we are always in communion with one another. At least this is what I experience during my near-death states, and whenever I have a spiritually transformative experience, I do not experience any sense of separateness, but always feel totally at one with all that is, which includes you, which includes everyone and everything. And so I just had this thought about maybe this is a tremendous visual thought form, because I remember many, many, many years ago, I actually saw a book that had photographs of thought forms, and it looked like inverted braille. So thoughts actually are things and do make impressions. Then to take it a step further, I was thinking about the impact that we as Reiki practitioners have on people and things, and it seems to me that that might be a similar principle.
Absolutely. I think, you know, to me as a musician, it becomes very obvious in music. We end up with a kind of frequency dialogue. That's all music is. It is one interacting with another. I remember many years ago I was at the Lomas Festival in Reading, and it was, you know, way after lights down and everything had finished. I'd gone back to the tent. And the festival there, you can imagine, you know, acres and acres full of land, full of tents, across a massive space. And at some point, someone obviously picked up a drum and started drumming. And then someone else joined in, and then someone else joined in. And within about 5-10 minutes, literally, all you could hear was this drumming response around the whole of the campsite. And it was such an amazing kind of feeling, such an amazing sound, because it was just this group of people talking to each other, communicating to each other, consciously, subconsciously, whatever you want to kind of say it, in musical form, creating this kind of amazing pattern that you could almost see it as a geometric pattern. You could almost feel it, because it was around you, it was in front of you, behind you, to either side, almost felt as if it was above you and below you, as the sound went through the earth and so forth. And effectively, you know, to me, that's exactly what's kind of going on. It's interesting you mentioned about thought forms and patterns. One of the other patterning things that's been shown with frequency, and again, sound, is that if you speak into water, you get ripples. If you speak into something like, I don't know, metal filings, you get the same ripples. But of course, the thing about metal filings is once the ripples are stopped, the pattern stays there, so you can see what pattern it is. And they found that different frequencies, different sounds, literally projected onto metal filings, will make different patterns. Again, a lot of which have been found in crop circle patterns. They're the same kind of patterns, so we've definitely got some kind of energetic response going on there that is produced, if you like, and modulated by our own thoughts, by our own way of thinking things, by our own way of communicating with the universe that is ourselves, a reflection of ourselves.
Well, as a fellow musician myself, I've always related to things that way, and I'm always referring to things in frequency. For example, the waveform of love is a very high vibrational frequency, whereas the waveform of fear is a very low, dense vibrational frequency. So when people say you can't mix love and fear, that's the absolute truth. It really
I'm giggling there because there was a program on early on in the week on telly over here that...
Hello, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale back again. Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, we lost our call. But I wanted to let you know we've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source, and I've had the wonderful honor of having Steve Mitchell. He is the producer of the film Dragons and Rings. So I hope that you will get that DVD soon. It's really been lovely having him with us. Please tune in next week when we're going to talk to Robert Kaplan and his amazing near-death experience. This is Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. We will speak to you next week. Love and light to all of you.